All right, folks, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuck sticks, what's happening? What is happening? Happy New Year. Or it's New Year. Here we go. Yeah, that's better. Not Happy New Year. Here we go again. Hang on, this one's going to be nuts. And nuts is a diplomatic description, I think. I made no resolutions. I had some idea that maybe I would change some things, and maybe I will. I kind of stuck it in my head, but I didn't draw any lines. I don't need a reason to beat the shit out of myself. It's something that happens naturally. Maybe my resolution should be not to do that. How about that one? How about let's not beat the shit out of ourselves? Can you do that? Because there is a difference. You know, there's a difference between beating the shit out of yourself and being hard on yourself. My guest today is Bruce Springsteen, the boss from Jersey. I went to Jersey, and I was I'll tell you more about that experience in a second. But I was reading his book. I immersed myself in a lot of Bruce's music, and I read most of his book. I didn't get through it. I got just past Darkness at the Edge of Town. It's pretty much chronological from his childhood through his music, through his experience with his father. Talked a lot about his relationship with John Landau, his producer, who was originally a music writer and his great friend, and a lot of other relationships in his life. But it's written beautifully. It's very poetic. It's very self-aware. This is definitely Bruce Springsteen looking back and reflecting and seeing who he was and is. But the interesting thing for me was that I noticed that he's very hard on himself. And that resonated with me because he is a one of a kind. He's very prolific. He's an amazing entertainer. He moves millions of people. People love him. And he's hard as hell on himself. And I started thinking about the difference between, you know, being hard on yourself and beating the shit out of yourself. They're just different. And I think that the difference is it has to do with your drive. You know what I mean? It's like... If you beat the shit out of yourself, you're just driving yourself into the ground. If you're being hard on yourself, you might get better. You might drive yourself to get better. But it's a very fine line. It has something to do with your disposition. I mean, if you think you suck and you just tell yourself that all the time, I suck, without any, you know, real recourse or without any forward thinking, that's a disposition. I suck. I've convinced myself again that I suck. But if you're hard on yourself and you think you're great, you're just not as good as you want to be yet, then you might get better. I mean, it's a mild adjustment. But sometimes people are just too comfortable in sucking and too comfortable in self-pity and too comfortable in, you know, I'm fucked, to make that mild adjustment to like, you know, yeah, I'm fucked, but I'm going to get better. I'm pretty fucking good. And that's, you know, that's what Bruce Springsteen had, obviously. You know, talent and courage, you know, will also determine the outcome. And one of those is sort of God-given. The other one you have to earn somehow. But I'm going to talk to Bruce. If you let me do a little New Year's stuff here in the beginning, that would be nice. You can scramble on forward if you want, but I do have some things to say. The day before New Year's Eve, I watched Adam Curtis's new documentary, Hypernormalization, and I would highly recommend you go find that thing. It's a beautiful piece of journalism. It's a very interesting 2.5 hours that will expand your mind, blow your mind. I'm not going to say it's going to give you hope. It may be a little bleak in some ways, but at least you'll have the information. And I don't want to tip too much, but it starts... It tracks two stories at the beginning. One beginning in Damascus in 1975, and alongside of that, New York City in 1975. And he's able to start there and run through all levels: politics, power, money, technology. And he sort of pulls back the veil on some things and frames things in a way through history and through connectivity and filmmaking that will really blow your fucking mind. So in the new year, I would recommend that so you can get a little depth in terms of what is really happening. And I believe it's in there. And I don't believe that too often. So heading into the new year, I got an email that I think is a nice way to start the new year, if I could. And the subject line is, WTF can make babies happen. Hi, Mark and the people of WTF. I just wanted to share a little story with you for the new year. Bear with me. About 5 years ago, I moved from London to Barcelona. I left my friends and my job and my city of 11 years, all for a woman. This might sound like the beginning of one of those stories of woe and heartbreak, which ends with me living on the street in urine-soaked clothes, yelling at strangers and collecting plastic bags, but it isn't. The last 9 months have been pretty wild. My girlfriend got pregnant in the midst of me and my buddy pushing to finish filming on a documentary that we are working on. I left my job and started working for a great company. Meanwhile, my girl's belly grew and grew, and I panicked late at night when no one was around. I read shitty parenting books. I looked for wisdom from fathers and mothers. I walked. I cried at dumb songs and movies. I thought about my ego and being a dad. I felt far away from my family and my friends. So 9 months later, the due date came and went. 2 days, hot bath. 3 days, massage. 4 days, a spicy curry. 5 days, a long walk. 6 days, a fight. We tried everything. On the 7th day, I was doing the dishes and listening to an episode, and I decided on impulse that I would put my headphones on her stomach and let my little girl hear some of your final guitar noodling and a little Boomer Lives. The little bun in the oven kicked up a storm, and a short 20 minutes later, her water broke. The contractions came every 8 minutes, then 6, then 5, then 4, then 3. I ran around like a loon and got everything ready. I pulled up the car, and we left for the hospital. A 24-hour labor marathon and emergency C-section later, my sweet baby girl, Greta, was brought into the world. I was taken to meet her alone in a little room off the operating theater while my girlfriend was being stitched back together. I left her there, again on impulse, and was just handed my daughter and left alone in a tiny room. She was calm, staring up at me. I had tears streaming down my face. Today, I was thinking of your episode with Louis C.K. and how he cried telling the same story. I cried then listening to it, and I cried when it happened to me, and I'm tearing up a little now. Anyway, man, she's beautiful. She's made a shitty year feel like it never happened. And she made this shitty person feel like he can never be shitty again. I've spent Christmas with my girls, and I feel like a new man. I feel like a dad. It's in there, Mark. I highly recommend it. Well, let's not go crazy, pal. I just wanted to thank you for what you do, share something with you, and thanks for all the brilliant people who have told their stories on your show. And I wanted to personally thank you for your cry of Boomer Lives, which sparked my baby's mind into this life. Even if you read this or not, I just wanted you to know I love you, Marin. Can't wait for Springsteen. Greta Lives, Neil in Barcelona. So Bruce Springsteen. So Brendan and I drive to Jersey. Here's how I come into Bruce. I flew to New York because I had this opportunity to spend an hour with Bruce Springsteen, the boss, a mythic person. He is unto himself. He is the boss. He is Bruce Springsteen. And the funny thing is like, I like Bruce Springsteen, but I'm not crazy. You know, like I'm a fan, but I'm not like, oh God. And that was helpful because I went through most of his catalog, listening to it again, most of it, and really kind of entering the world of Bruce Springsteen at the age I'm at now, 53, getting a new appreciation for things that I was familiar with. I remember when I was a teenager, I had Greetings from Asbury Park. I had the E Street Shuffle record. I had Born to Run. I had The River. I bought Nebraska. I was definitely in. And the weird thing about getting the opportunity to interview him is I was going back to New Jersey. Now, I don't know how many of you know this. Some of you do. I'm a New Jersey boy. I was born in New Jersey. Both of my parents are from New Jersey. And I left New Jersey very young, but I'm New Jersey, genetically New Jersey. That's just the truth of it. And as I was preparing in my mind to talk to Bruce, knowing that I had an hour, I needed to somehow connect with him. As many of you who listen to the show, I really wanted to connect personally with Bruce Springsteen. And I knew we're both genetically New Jersey. He's from Asbury Park area, and my great-grandfather owned an Army surplus store in Toms River. My aunt still lives down in Oakhurst, and I used to go to Deal Beach in Asbury Park. My grandparents lived in an apartment at the end of the Asbury Park boardwalk. I have that in my life, in my past. And when Brendan and I drove out to the Jersey Shore, I had a lot of that thinking. I was thinking a lot about that. My grandparents are buried in Elizabeth just off the highway. It was like trying to find some genetic connection to Jersey again, and then to connect with Bruce Springsteen, who is one of the most powerful representatives of New Jersey. So heading into it, that's what I was thinking about. And that's difficult when, and I have this with a lot of musicians, when you have An hour. I have an hour with Bruce Springsteen. I'm going to his house. So we drive in. We get there early and we end up going to Dunkin' Donuts. So I got jacked up and ate, you know, two muffins and a giant Dunkin' Donuts coffee. And then we drove out to the estate, the farm. We went through security. We were shown to this separate building. It looked like a stable, but it was a studio. And we were met by the publicist and a guy who works for Bruce, a carpenter on the property, who hooked up the plugs and plugged us in. And he just left us in this room with like 100 or so guitars, acoustics, electrics, keyboards of all kinds, you know, a huge board. There was a separate living room area and a bathroom. We had coffee. There were some cronuts there. And we were just there hanging around for a half an hour. And I didn't touch a guitar. I just looked, and it seemed like there was another room past the studio that had some motorcycles in it. But it was beautiful. It was all beautiful. And, you know, the excitement was sort of starting to build. And then I'm just looking out the window, and I see Bruce walking down from the house. Just Bruce Springsteen kind of walking around the corner into where we are. And he walked in, and I said, hey, man, I just want you to know I didn't touch any of the guitars. He went, oh, okay. I say, yeah, I have a nice guitar. I play guitar, but I didn't touch any. He's like, good. And then he walked me around, showed me some guitars. He showed me that he had somehow found the first guitar he played and the first amp, the first setup. It wasn't the original equipment, but he went out and found the first pieces of equipment he had as a guitar player. Obviously, there were a few Tellys around, but there's a lot of different types of guitars. We talked about guitars a little off mic, and then we sat down, and we got into it. And there was just some, you know, this was one of those things where I wanted to relate and get to know Bruce Springsteen. And I was, it was an amazing experience. So before I get into this, I need to tell you that, you know, you can get his book, The Memoir Born to Run, and the audio companion, Chapter and Verse. They're now available. So they're out there. And I've enjoyed the book very much. But that aside, whew, okay, this is me and Bruce Springsteen, the boss, in New Jersey, in his studio, sitting face to face. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. Ace. I'm using 58s, Shure's, Beta 58s.
The Shure's we used in, I'm trying to think which the ones were we used back in my first band. They didn't have the bulb on the end. They were the straight-ended.
Oh, really?
They were the high end of what every local rock band used. Right. If you had your Shure mic, you were good?
Know,
you were good. And a 50-watt amplifier. To run your PA.
Oh, right. Just like one speaker or two speakers?
Two speakers, two column speakers.
And, just that, and then the box with the knobs?
Yes.
Right.
On columns.
Right. The kind that you'd see at any event.
And if you had any sort of echo rigged up, you were way, way, way ahead of the game.
Yeah. The raw goods of rock and roll are very simple.
Yeah, very
you don't,
simple.
You don't need much of anything.
No. What, you don't need a lot.
I read. Here's where I'm at. I'll be honest with you, with the book. I just finished Darkness.
Okay.
So like I didn't get to the end. Does it end happy? Is there a happy ending?
You'll have to finish it and tell me.
You're not clear on it. It's like it's a beautiful book, you know. Because and I locked into it and I just kept going with it. So now, like, I feel like I'm in your head, and now I have to get out of your head and into the present here.
Okay.
How, now, when you're sitting around, what are you getting? You're getting ready for Christmas now?
Correct.
Yeah. So it's nothing but chaos up there in the house?
You are correct.
My whole family's from Jersey. I never lived here, really, except when I was a little kid. And, you know, in Asbury Park, like, my grandparents lived in Asbury Park. Like, down at the end of the boardwalk in that one white building.
They were, they,
and there's pictures of me in those boats.
The little swan boats.
Right. The ones in the went in a circle. The rides. There was rides there, right?
Oh, those boats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The little circled.
Yes.
Pretend power boats.
That's right. And you remember those?
Of course.
And then I remember it got real shitty there. But I was thinking about it. It's a weird thing. And I'm going to talk. I'm just talking for a minute. Because I talked to my dad because I wanted to track where my, before I came over here. Like, my great-grandfather owned a surplus, Army surplus store in Toms River.
Right.
And my, you know, and then all of a sudden, my father, I says, yeah, my father used to go down to Asbury Park, and he'd go to Springfield Avenue and do whatever the hell he was.
Springwood Avenue.
Springwood.
Yeah.
And he said he got involved with, what, like, there are these bits of information, because my relationship with my old man's not great either, but he's still around. And you get these bits of information about your parents. Or your grandparents.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like, holy shit, there's a whole world I didn't fucking understand.
That they lived in.
Yeah.
Well, Springwood Avenue was the spot in town for a long time. Had Fish's Clothing Store,
yeah.
Which was the Superfly store if you were looking for
the latest
rig, you
yeah.
know? So people traveled from all over to go to Fish's Clothing Store on Springwood Avenue.
And what was that? Was that was it a black neighborhood?
Yeah,
primarily.
Yeah,
yeah. It was weird that you get this secret history of your family. Like, I didn't get the feeling that my grandfather was going down there for good reasons.
Uh huh.
And I don't know. Like, when I read the book, the struggle to become who you are seems to go all the way through it.
That's what we're all doing.
Right. But you know that feeling when because I identify so strongly with the father stuff where, you know, you're sort of left on your own to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that was part of the problem.
Yeah.
But also part of the solution.
In retrospect, do you think, when you think about your old man, are you able now to, and maybe this is too heavy to start out with, but are you able now to see that, like, you know, which parts of him that you got that are good?
Of course.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What'd you land on?
Well, you look back, you know, he had his own arc. I forget when we were probably having our biggest troubles, I was 16, which would have made him, let me think, 31 or 2.
Young.
Yeah, you know. So he's a young guy.
Right.
And he was, you know, still deep into sort of, he had his mental issues, and then he was also deep into sorting. He'd never sorted those things out for himself. So,
drinking a lot, too.
You know, yeah, yeah, the beer.
Yeah.
The beer, you know. So my folks left me in 1969, which was a little unusual. Usually you're leaving them, but they left me in New Jersey in 1969 and went to California.
Right.
So that sort of left you on your own to continue parenting yourself as best as you could. And, you know, your life was yours from that point on.
Right.
You know?
And that
suited me.
Yeah,
you know, it was just one of the things that, for where I was at, I was independent already. I had the band, I had my own little community that I was a part of. I was making a few bucks on the weekend, so I could survive, and I was happily independent.
Right.
So,
not making a lot of money.
No,
right.
Of course you're making right. $20,
right?
But anybody that couldn't live on $20 or $40 in 1969, having no dependents and
right.
no, you know, anybody could do that. You
right.
know, so
it was a different time.
Yeah, I mean, you ate for, you know, $3 a day,
right.
$4 a day was
yeah.
all you needed to eat. So yeah. it was just enough money to get by and have a good time on.
And when you started playing rock and roll, when you started playing, like when you decided that was going to be it, what's sort of fascinating about me, this stuff, you know, after listening to your music my whole life, that you always had this sort of this working ethic about that it wasn't going to come easy ever.
Right. Right.
And that you know, you, maybe you in particular, I don't know how other people do it, we're going to have to, you know, work twice as hard as anybody else.
Well, as long as you didn't expect it to come easy, you were fine, you know. And also, the work was a part of a project of self-realization.
Yeah.
That everybody has to go through in those early periods of their youth, through their 20s and into their 30s.
Yeah.
So I had a tool that assisted me in doing that. You know, it was the collecting of my thoughts in song, and the measuring of my progress through music.
Yeah.
You know, not necessarily through success.
Right.
But through the music itself. Is it getting better? Am I getting better? Am I becoming more realized as a musician? And then therefore, hopefully, as a human being. And so I had this whole project that I was working on from when I was really 14 years old that I was deeply, deeply, deeply involved in, that was giving my life a course to follow, a center, a meaning, joy, fun. And I was sort of merrily just working in the coal mine, you know?
Right.
And I didn't have a problem with that. As I got older and I listened to the radio and started to think, well, gee, I'm as good as a lot of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, why am I undiscovered? Yeah. Which, of course, there were a lot of reasons. In those days, you might as well have been in Egypt as be in New Jersey.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
People just, it was the localism of the music scenes in those days,
yeah,
was all. So no one came down from New York. Yeah, let's go discover somebody in Asbury Park.
Not going to happen.
No. Let's take our A&R guys down to the Jersey Shore.
Where?
And see who's right. Fabulous down there.
Yeah.
No, that wasn't going to occur.
And it was all cover bands, too, you said, that there was a lot of R&B stuff, but it was not a lot of original music.
No, it was all your sort of cover bands that worked all the shore clubs.
Yeah.
Because the shore was sort of a faux Fort Lauderdale at the time.
Right.
You know, and so as I say in the book, we had to dig out a little bar that was doing no business.
Right.
Ask the guy if we could play for a dollar at the door.
The Student Prince bar?
Yeah. And go to work
to
there.
To jam.
Yeah, go to work there.
Now, when you were going through all this, like, you know, the one thing, like getting back to that idea that it seems to me that, you know, from the small bits and pieces that you talk about your family, well, there's a lot about your family, but those moments with your old man, it seemed like he had a lot of fuck you attitude to him.
Well,
I mean, just about the this and then that, things that outside of him.
Yeah, it wasn't so much as that as he was just lost within himself, you know, like the project that I'm describing was one that he never undertook.
Yeah.
And if you don't undertake that project, you're lost in the wilderness at a certain age, you
right.
know? And so I always look at my dad as of course he had this anger and frustration and humiliation, but he was also just a guy that was lost in the wilderness. You know, he'd never undertaken that project to find your course and steer it towards something. So, and then of course what I was doing looked ridiculous to him because it might to a parent looking at their kid who's spending 10 hours in the day just whacking on the guitar
right.
in their room, you know. But
you think that was it, that it was just that, you know, he not self-realized and he had depression on top of it.
Yeah, he you know, all of those things sort of contributed to, I think what he would have felt was an unsuccessful life, which is not necessarily how I look upon it right now. I mean, he had three children, he raised solid citizens, and my mother was a fabulous partner, and there was actually a lot of joy in his life, but I think he was too at sea himself to appreciate it. And he had to put in on top of it, he was truly mentally ill, and that cast a shadow over everything.
And he didn't know that necessarily.
No, he certainly didn't know it, and really neither did the rest of us until we were probably into our 20s, and he was in his 40s, you know, well into his 40s.
That's a tough moment to like, you know, to sort of have to make that decision of giving him a pass out of empathy and compassion,
right,
or holding on to your own resentment.
Yeah, well, at some point, you know, I was never much a believer in holding deep grudges for the most part. And
for the most part.
You know, and he's, you know, your parents are someone, you love them regardless.
Yeah.
So I was just more interested in who he was, what that had to do with me, and also how I could be of service and helpful once I realized that I was going to be the parent and he was going to be the child.
Did that happen?
Yeah, it happened when he got very ill and he needed to be taken care of. And my mother had a limit to, because of her relationship with him, was limited as to how disciplined she could be with him. So it kind of fell on me to get to California, and I had to get him medicated, and I had to get him to the doctors, all of which he resisted doing. But he became a danger to himself and to others. And so...
What was it?
Huh?
Was it Alzheimer's or...?
No. It was just paranoid schizophrenic is what they call it at the time.
Is that what the diagnosis ended up being?
Yeah.
Really?
And so it was pretty intense because you're hearing voices and you're becoming very manic.
Mm-hmm.
You're going for days without sleep, and you know, he engaged in very manic behavior. And at some point he became very a risk to himself and mm-hmm. and to my mom and to the citizenry at large. So I had to go out and try to assist him in getting better, you know, which we were able to do after quite a big battle. So
getting him kind of, you know, locked up and medicated, then taken out.
Yeah, you know, he had to get treatment and the correct medication, and it improved his life greatly towards the last 15, 20 years of his life.
Wow. Well, that must be an amazing feeling as a son to be able to show up for that.
Yeah, it was. It was...
bittersweet.
It was good, you know, and to see him improve and enjoy his family. And he was never going to be normal. He wasn't going to be a normal father. You know, you weren't going to get...
I'm proud of you, son.
Yeah, you weren't going to, you know, get too much of that. So you had to accept that fact and, you know, take things for what they were and enjoy what you could get and at some point you obviously lose your anger about the rest because you see this was somebody who had to struggle very difficultly.
Yeah, losing anger is sort of a weird thing because it's a choice, yet when you're in it, it doesn't feel like you have a choice.
Well, when you're in it without understanding, but there are, as I say in the book, there are also irretrievable relationships where events have occurred that relationships don't come back from. I mean, I know plenty of people who had to sign off from their families for a variety of reasons, for good, healthy reasons, and move on with their lives.
Right.
So that can happen too.
Yeah.
But if the relationships are retrievable, and I felt like mine was, then it's there's a nice payback in seeing things, come closer and become a little more healthy.
To let go a little bit.
And let go of, look back on your anger as a part of, youthful misunderstandings. And of course, you had your reasons and there was bad behavior. My papa could be very cruel when he was young. And, it's not that you let that slide. You live with it. It's a part of your life. And if you're lucky, it's fuel for the fire. People don't end up in my circumstance who generally had these very placid, loving, very happy, fulfilled lives. It's not how you become a rock and roll star, You got to have some chaos, tumult, disastrous relationships, humiliation at a young age, feel disempowered, enormous amount of weakness, and suddenly things start to burn.
Yeah.
And when that burning starts, if you take that flame and you aim it towards the right thing, powerful weapon.
Yeah, yeah. and a powerful gift.
And powerful. If you were lucky and had the talent, it's a powerful gift.
Well, that's sort of the interesting thing about it is that when you don't get that thing from your old man, but your mother seemed like a real piece of work.
Yeah.
And just the attitude.
The solid citizen,
Right, right.
And
always sort of, moving through.
So I was lucky enough that I had a yin-yang.
Yeah, yeah.
If you had two people bailing on you, I have no idea, you could get so lost. But my mother was the opposite. She was the essence of consistency, the essence of unconditional love, always on your side, doing her best to guide you as much as she could, but mainly that feeling of the deep love that was in your life every day. So I had these two things that I was balancing, and those things did later show up in my music and as part of the yin-yang of my own music from the darkness, dark parts and the light parts. So it ended up being a very powerful balance that I grew up with.
And it's also interesting to have to reckon, to reckon with the fact that they're going to stay together. That the yin and yang, there's a several points in the book where they're sort of like, she couldn't leave him, he wasn't going to leave.
Right.
Because it was the responsibility of the situation, which I imagine had something to do with commitment and faith and maybe some religion.
Yeah, it wasn't the day of divorce or an easy out on things. My mother came from a divorced family. And I think she decided that was never going to happen to her.
Yeah. No matter what.
And my father provided, one of the things he did provide was a man that wasn't going to go anywhere. He was
literally not out of the house.
Yeah, they were stuck together forever and for good. And so I had to address them both as a couple. I always had to deal with them as a couple and deal with both sides of the coin.
Yeah, it's hard to figure out, I would imagine, the justice of that. That how do you you're in it and your dad's being abusive and your mom's, doing whatever she does and you've got to just deal with it.
Yeah, that's the lay of the land. Those are the cards you've been dealt. And when you're young, they're impossible to understand. How could you live in a house where there was so much kindness and great cruelty?
Yeah.
It was very, very difficult to understand those things, and it set you very on edge. You had your own little local minefield that you had to walk every single day, which caused a great deal of anxiety and neuroticism in me.
Right.
You were always on edge. You were always waiting for, you had this one great thing, but then you were always waiting for the other shoe to drop. Made me a very nervous kid.
Right. And also, there's two routes you go with that. When you have a drinking or abusive parent, either you become that or you become the guy that controls as much as you can.
And that was me.
Yeah.
That was me. I became the control guy.
Right.
I became, all right, I'm not going to go to the other side of this thing.
Yeah.
So I went the other way, and I said, okay, I've had enough drama. I've had enough unsureness and in my home. So I'm going to create a life where everything is very controlled, and I feel safe, and I feel like I can go about my business. So I worked very, very hard to do that. Obviously, that becomes a problem too, because you become too controlling and you squeeze out so much life.
Right.
From that, you can't live a life.
Because some things are uncontrollable.
Yeah. It's, in other words, if you want to live a life,
yeah,
you've got to realize you are not going to be the writer of your own script. Life is something that happens, you know. You don't happen to it. It happens to you. So you've got to allow it in all of its uncontrollable, often chaos, to come into your life. And the way you reach adulthood is you realize that you have the power to withstand the hurricane forces that uncontrolled events bring into your life.
Once you take a few hits.
Yeah, you know, but also what comes with those uncontrolled events? Love, happiness, fulfillment, satisfaction, you let all those things in too, which if you are a control nut, you squeeze out, because what's more dangerous
than love?
Than love. There's nothing more dangerous than that.
You don't know what the hell's going to happen.
That's right.
Yeah.
You don't know what the hell's going to happen.
You know you're
going
to get hurt.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, so you cannot be some control right. nut and allow that into your life with all the good things while feeling, well, the bad things are going to be so bad, I'm just not going to let that happen to me.
So what you do is you end up sort of building a wall. Yeah, I mean, you talk a little bit about boundaries in the book, but you know what you had to do in your mind was sort of build the wall.
Yes, I built quite a few of them, yeah.
Yeah, you know, just to protect this other part, which leads to this thing, you know, I do stand-up, and I've been doing it for years, and there was something I identified with in the book, which was, for some reason, and this is me now, and maybe you can help me. Maybe you already are. But I can open up in front of a crowd.
Yeah.
Like, and put it all out there.
Well, that's easy to do.
I guess, if you're that kind of person.
Correct.
Right. But like when I get home or when I'm in a relationship, you know, I'm like, what do you want? What's happening?
Well, there's certain kinds of people, you know, that only feel at home in a crowd. And
performing for them.
Performing
you have control, number one.
You have tremendous control. Tremendous control. Everybody's listening to you. Isn't that great?
But you know, but what about those times though? You know, like, you know, I don't know if you ever did it, but like it seems like that you really kind of had a practical way of addressing fear. You know, heading into things, like you didn't want it. I have to assume it was there, but somehow,
of course,
right. But did you ever have those nights where you know you that one place where you have control, you go up? And it's like, listen, I mean, I know you talk about one gig in London.
Yeah, of course. But your desperation has to be greater than your fear. You know, your desperation, your hunger, your desires, your ego, your ambition has to be greater than your fear of complete humiliation. And so as long as you have that equation correctly balanced, you're going out there, my friend, no matter what happens. Because you have to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but it's like, it's funny, though, because like there was an interesting realization that you had. And I assume a lot of this stuff in the book, it's you thinking about this stuff. Like, I have to assume that some of the stuff you write in the book about the past is you now going like, oh yeah, well now that I know this,
of course,
that's what I was doing.
Of course.
But back then you're like,
who knows?
Yeah, I'm just going.
All of this stuff is inside me.
Right.
Working its magic.
Yeah.
And I'm just following it, and I'm stumbling out on stage because I have to. I'm not sure why I have to at the time. And then I'm just, you know, exploding and letting things take their course.
But those nights where it's like that, you didn't get the love you needed out there, that's bad.
Well, that, I mean, that, it's a
because
bad
that means
yeah.
there ain't no love nowhere. You know, that's why those nights are bad. Yeah. If you've squeezed all the rest out of your daily life and then you're not getting it there,
ooh.
There ain't no love nowhere, my friend. It's a lonely world when that happens.
And you went through months like that.
Well, sure. I mean, now most of the time, you know,
not about the crowds, but where you were out in the exile in a way. You know,
I went
doing
through that for years, you know, years and years, you know, in my real life.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I always fell back on my pretend life where I got to pretend I was Bruce Springsteen. And I always had that to fall back on for 3 or 4 hours a night, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. When things get real dark, it's sort of like, let's do the show.
Yeah. At least that's something that I know where the fuck I am, you
right?
know?
Yeah.
That's just it, that's do your the place. Show.
Yeah.
I'm safe there. I know what's going on. I know what's expected of me. I have no problem busting my ass to deliver it. And at the end of the evening, I can go home and put my head to sleep on my pillow in a short moment of peace.
I did it.
I did it.
And then you wake up.
And hell starts all over again. But
yeah, you just sort of like, you know, that elation, that's victory.
It.
And then
it.
You just wake up and it's like, oh, fuck.
That's right.
Now what?
I'm back. I'm back in the real world.
No more cape. I don't got my superhero outfit on anymore.
That's right.
So, is that where... I mean, that real world thing and the, you know, the difference between the two. I mean, how difficult did that get for you on a day-to-day basis?
Well, when you're young, it's not that different. When
of
you're
course,
25, you know.
You're sleeping in the beach or on some
yeah,
floor.
Life is grand, yeah. you know. And you don't have that much off time because you're touring constantly and you don't think anything's wrong. You know, you have girlfriends, they're kind of coming and they're going,
yeah.
and that's kind of natural. That's
yeah.
that's the way life is. When you get to be 35 and 32, something starts creeping in, you know, that's telling you, well, you know, you've had enough you've done enough of sort of the coming and going to realize something's broke.
Oh, yeah?
Something's broke.
Like that shit ain't working.
Yeah, so something's wrong, you know, either with me or with the people I'm choosing or just
right.
there's something broken in the machine. So you start to realize that starts to creep into you when your own, people always talk about women have a body clock, but I think that men have one too. And when they get into that early 30s
yeah.
and mid-30s, you start thinking about, okay, where's the rest of my life?
Right.
Where is
I'm a success. Why am I sitting here in this void?
Yeah, where's the rest of my life, you know? And why don't I have one? I mean, shouldn't I have one? Isn't, you know,
I worked for it.
Haven't I figured out all the
Right.
Haven't I figured out all the big problems, you know?
I got all the answers.
Yeah, and that's when you realize when it finally lands on you,
yeah.
you realize, oh my God, I'm back to zero in this area. And this area has nothing to do with the craft that I have, with this fortress I have built for myself
yeah.
for 30 some years. In this other area, I'm completely naked in the desert. There is no fortress.
Right, right.
It doesn't exist.
Right.
And so... suddenly, when you realize that, you realize how adrift you are, and you realize that life plays a nasty little joke on you, and that you can become quite mature and quite successful and quite developed in one area and be completely retarded in another part of your personality.
Did you find that was, see, like, because I've dealt with some of that, but like you seem to have dealt with it in your 30s. I'm just feeling that now.
Because, oh, boy.
Because I didn't get successful until I was in my 40s.
Right.
So So the feeling of getting that thing shored up, like, I'm going to be okay there.
Right.
You know, took me a lot longer.
Right.
So now I'm sort of like, well, that's okay. And I thought that would answer a lot of questions. But then you're like,
You think it's going to answer all your questions.
Well, you'd be okay, at least. How can you not feel good?
Yeah.
And then you're not. And then, you know, then I start to realize, because, you know, my father's got a bipolar, and I got some of that in my family. But, like, with me, I was so anxious and shit. Like, what I realized was I didn't trust anybody.
Of course. Why would you?
Exactly. And then, you know, it's like, so how, you're not going to let anybody in.
That's
so
right.
So all this stuff, no matter how many people you got around, the band, the women, that's whoever, right. You're still alone.
No, I built a thing where I would survive alone. I didn't trust anybody after my parents left. And after I had some very close people who died on me, my grandparents, I said, whoa, this world will kick your ass and burn you inside out. I don't trust anything or anybody that I haven't built myself.
Right.
And so you go about building, and you keep the world at large, at bay, you know, and that's how you live.
Yeah.
And you believe that not only that's how you live, that's how you can live forever.
Right.
And then you reach a point where you realize that, yes, you have built yourself a fortress and you are locked inside.
Right.
By your, you know, all by your little lonely self. And that's when you realize, I got to go outside.
Mm.
I got to go outside, but I don't like outside.
Yeah.
I don't like what's outside. I don't trust any of the people outside.
Yeah.
You know, I only trust myself when I'm doing what I do.
And other people are doing what I hope they tell them to
do. My audience is there. Yeah. But outside of that, I don't trust the world at all, man. The world is dangerous and scary.
How'd you get out there?
Well, you got to go. You know, you got to go.
Well, I mean, when, like, in the music, like, because, like, when I'm talking to you, you know, face to face, you know, I can hear through the work the resolution of those problems intellectually and emotionally.
But I put all of these things, I got to a point where I hit a wall and I realized, man, I am locked inside this thing.
What year was that? Like, what were you doing creatively?
I wrote Nebraska. And I took this trip across the country that I mentioned in the book.
Yeah.
And during that trip, I felt so alienated from everything that I was coming in contact with that when I hit the West Coast, where I had bought myself a small home, and I realized I can't live here.
This isn't New Jersey.
And this little house is closing me in.
Oh, really?
Get me back on the road.
Yeah, yeah.
But I realized that if I got back on the road, I was just going to bounce back to the East Coast and feel the same way and bounce back again. I realized I'd run out of my options. All my rock and roll medications had come to a point where, okay, that part of your life where all those things worked for you and you thought you were okay is over now. It's over. You're never going to feel that those things can make you feel completely all right again.
So, like, Nebraska was almost a cry for help in a way.
It's over. It's over. Yeah. It was over then, you know? And so now you're going, oh my God, I got to go out. And that was when I got into the analysis, because I didn't have a key or a clue as to how to put my foot in the real world. I was 30 some years old and still doing every deal I had was in pure cash. I didn't have a checkbook. I didn't have a credit card. If I wanted anything, I paid for it in cash.
Yeah.
And so I was in my own little, you know, my own little dream world.
And John Landau told you to...
And he was the guy that said, yeah, you need professional help.
And that's not something you would grow up with.
No.
You probably had a natural aversion to
it. Of course.
Who the hell does that?
I didn't know anybody.
Working people didn't do that.
See, I never knew anyone, with the exception of John himself, who I did trust greatly, But with the exception of, I never knew anyone who had anything like that. And I grew up around sick people. I mean, I grew up around people
we don't get help.
No, who were deeply, deeply mentally ill.
But if Jesus doesn't work, then we're going to live with it.
You know, you went off to the county home.
Yeah.
You know, is where you went.
Right.
And I grew up around people who were seriously mentally ill, and no one really got any help. So this was a revolution for me, but it was the thing that worked. You know, I went in and I a lot of the things we're talking about, I gave a name to.
You got tools.
Yeah, and I said, okay, oh, I got it. This is all this playing. This is just this. It's not everything. Everything,
compartmentalizing.
Yeah, everything is still waiting for me.
Right.
But to get to everything, I got to go out where everything is. And I don't like to do that.
Everything being
life, love, you know,
children.
The world at large, children, you know. And to go out there, I got to go out there where life and the world is going to happen to me.
But that's an interesting thing to me, because like now if I really think about the music and I think about that relationship that you have with your audience, a very specific audience in a way. They love you and they look up to you. You speak for them, because in the midst of all your understanding poetically, you know, both light and darkness, and the charisma that you bring to the show, there was a certain purity to it.
Yeah.
Like there was almost an innocence to it, because, you know, you were working this stuff out mentally.
Yeah.
That, you know, emotionally you were connecting to others' stories and moving some of your own emotions through it. But because of your kind of almost because of the world you built with for yourself, they were experiencing you as this pure being.
Well, the funny thing is I was writing about it richly in my music.
Right.
I just wasn't living it.
Right.
You know?
And you in the book, you have that amazing passage where you said that because your father was incommunicative, you had to picture both sides of the conversation in your own head and resolve issues that were going on between you and him in the characters that you built in your own head. So your empathy was huge, but perhaps embracing.
That came, part of that is I always believe it's a genetic predisposition to being a certain kind of person. My mother was extremely sensitive. We had a lot of empaths on her side of the family, and I got dealt those cards, which were very helpful when it comes to watching and writing music and experiencing life in other people's shoes and putting yourself in other people's places. It's a great way to work, not always the best way to live. But
because you get crushed.
Yeah, you get crushed, you know. And so you got to learn how to, then you have to learn how to do that and be that person while at the same time putting up some very sane, where you need to put up some very sane and protective
boundaries.
Right.
You know? So you don't get taken advantage of, which you were at times.
Many times.
Yeah.
You know, and so I had to learn like, oh, I got it. I'm really in control here, but I'm kind of a sucker for all these other things.
That's it.
When they come my way.
You're a mark.
I'm a mark for all these other things. I had a classic thing happen to me in New York City where I got caught in a classic New York City con game.
No kid, three-card Monty?
No.
Oh, wait.
Guy came up to me on the street.
Yeah. This is when you were Bruce Springsteen?
Yeah.
Okay. People
knew
you.
Guy came up to me on the street, said he was from South Africa, came into town, taxi driver picked him up, got dropped off.
Lost a briefcase?
Lost the briefcase. It's at Madison Square Garden. It's filled with money.
Yeah.
And I'm going, oh, how can I help you? And this leads to a variety of other circumstances where I finally end up on a street corner and a guy who says, I've got a gun in my pocket, because I finally realized I'm caught in something here.
Yeah.
It's not bogus.
Yeah.
You know, and I end up walking away anyway. But I said, hey, why am I the guy that out of the thousands of people on the street that day, somebody looked at me and said, that's my man.
Yeah. 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 I know that feeling.
You know, that's my man. And I said, okay, I'm putting something out here that's great sometimes, but not so good in everyday life.
That's a tough realization.
It was. I had to realize, whoa.
Yeah, because then you got to learn how to look hard.
I'm kind of stupid this way.
I don't know what it is, because it's like, you know, either you got that. It's like William Burroughs said, you can't hide the mark inside.
No, you can't. You can't.
Right.
And it took me a long time to realize that a part of me was that person, and then to start to build the boundaries that not only were good for me, but were good for the people that were around me, because I wasn't doing them any service either, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of the beginning. It was an adult thing to do.
Well, you got to learn how to go like, no, I can't.
No, you got to learn. You got to learn the
yeah,
no word.
Yeah, yeah,
no,
yeah.
You know,
can't
to,
do it.
Yeah, to your friends or to people that are it. You got to learn how to, you know, say no, I can't. And for me, that was really hard, because I'd heard no, I can't so often when I was a child. I said, I'm not going to say no to anybody. When I grow up, I'm not going.
Yeah,
there.
Gonna give it all away.
Yeah, I'm not going. I'm gonna give everything away. And so,
and you trusted people stupidly.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah,
completely. I both was somebody who didn't trust anyone, and trusted everyone.
Yeah.
At the same time, when I went outside, so.
But you trusted your creative vision, you know. So
yeah.
like that ego you're talking about, which I can kind of identify with, in the sense that sort of like, I'm gonna be big, you know. I'm gonna do it my way.
Yeah, and also I idealized people in my songs, and so I then projected that onto, you know, just whoever I met, you know.
Oh, sure, right.
Which plenty of times worked out great, and then, but sometimes not so great.
But right, but the stubbornness, really, like, there's some points in your career where you were like, you know, this is the my way thing served you, you know, greatly.
Yeah,
and that, you know, you fought the good fights for your creative vision. That eventually paid off.
Yeah.
But it was a hard time.
Yeah.
There was one bit in the book that like struck me just because of what we're living through now. There was a moment in the book where you talked about the high school principal encouraging the, you know, you had the rah-rahs and the greasers and then the meatheads. But, you know, there was this was a high school thought. But, you know, when you were a long hair and you were going to go to graduation, that he subtly encouraged anybody to get you in line.
Yeah.
You know, which we now have a president-elect.
He's that high school principal.
Yeah, the guy who's going to sick the bad guys on you. Like, I can't do it myself, but I'm not saying you should.
So somebody knocked that guy in the face.
Right, right. That's scary.
Not me, but somebody do it. I'll pay the bill.
I'm not even going to tell you to do it. I'm just saying it wouldn't bother me if you did.
Exactly.
And that's, you know, it's like, when I think about, I don't know, are you scared now?
Yeah. Yeah, of course. How could you not be?
Right. Have you felt this fear before?
No.
Right.
I've felt disgust before.
Right.
But never the kind of fear that you feel now.
Right.
It's simply the fear of, is someone simply competent enough to do this particular job?
Right.
Forget about where they are ideologically.
Right.
Do they simply have the pure competence?
Right. Right.
To be put in the position of such, you know, in responsibility.
He's so, like, when you've done the amount of self work you've done, and you've grown up the way you've grown up, and you know people, it's sort of like they elected the most insecure, you know, needy, volatile dude. And like, you know, to do this job like that somehow or another, I don't think it embodies strength to a lot of people, but
no.
It does embody fuck you.
Yeah.
There's just like, it's just, they just voted for, like, who are you voting for? The fuck you guy.
That happened.
Yeah. That happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, so I started thinking about, like, this weird thing about the themes of your music and the people that, you know, you empower and empathize for, people in your life, your younger sister who live a working class life.
Of course.
And times are tough. But, you know, that shift, and I think you might have suggested it in the book a little bit, that the strength that comes through faith or determination to deal with adversity is that that's a celebration of the American spirit. But once adversity tips into hopelessness, however that looks, and you've written those characters too, you know, and they've acted, you know, sometimes badly, But when the hopelessness, you know, has no place to go, this is where we're at.
You're right.
So how do you, like, where's your empathy around that? You know, I know people that voted for him. You live in New Jersey. You probably know a few.
Of course.
And then you have that moment where you're like, well, who the fuck are you? Who are you? I thought I knew you.
Yeah. I mean, I understand how he got elected.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you were affected deeply by the deindustrialization and globalization and the technological advances, and you have been left behind, that somebody comes along and tells you, I'm going to bring all the jobs back. Don't worry about it. They're all coming back, you know. And you're concerned about America changing, the Browning of America, I'm going to build a wall. You're worried about ISIS, I got a secret plan to defeat ISIS. Don't worry about that. You're worried about terrorism in the United States. I'm going to register the Muslims and we're going to ban. I mean, these are all very simplistic, but very powerful and simple ideas. I mean, they're lies. They can't occur, mm-hmm. you know, but
if they do occur, they can't lead to a better place.
Yeah. You know, yeah. But if you've struggled for the past 30 or 40 years, and this has been the very themes of much of my creative life for all those years, somebody comes along and offers you something else, particularly after you feel you've been failed by the two parties, you know, that it's a compelling choice. And it just appeals to your worst angels. And under certain circumstances, you know, enough people went there. Not a majority of the people, but enough.
And what's your biggest fear of it as we enter it?
I suppose would be that a lot of the worst things and the worst aspects of what he appealed to comes to fruition. Mm. You know, when you let that genie out of the bottle, bigotry, racism. When you let those things out of the bottle,
intolerance, they
don't go back in the bottle that easily, if they go back in at all.
Right.
You know, whether it's a rise in hate crimes, people feeling they have license to speak and behave in ways that previously were considered un-American and are un-American. That's what he's appealing to. And so my fears are that those things find a place in ordinary civil society, demeans the discussions and events of the day, and the country changes in a way that is unrecognizable, and we become estranged. As you say, hey, wait a minute, you voted for Trump. I thought I knew who you were. You know, I'm not sure. You know, the country feels very estranged. You feel very estranged from your countrymen, you know?
Yeah.
So those are all dangerous things that, and we don't even know, you know, he hasn't even taken office yet.
And everyone's, yeah.
And it's bad.
Those of us who panic are panicking.
Yeah, you know, so we got to wait and see. But those are certainly the implications. And if you also look at who he's been picking for his cabinet, it doesn't speak very well for what's coming up. You know, those are all things that you know, I'm very frightened of and waiting to see play out. And all you can do is say, well, I'm going to do my best to, hey, America is still America. I believe in its ideals, and I'm going to do my best to play my very, very small part in maintaining those.
Are you writing about it?
No, I haven't written about it. You know, it takes a while to digest all those things. And even I don't know if I will, you know, because I don't write, I don't go, okay, I need a Trump album. That's what's got to come
next.
No,
but I think if you look at, you know, certainly your heroes and certainly, you know, your shift into the power of popular folk music and what, you know, folk music meant. Like, you know, it's interesting.
Well, I've got a lot of songs that are about it right now.
I know.
You know?
They're all there. That's done.
Yeah, they're there. Yeah. You know, they're kind of there already. You know, if I work from the inside out. In other words, I'm inspired by something internally and I make a record based on what I can write about at a given moment. sometimes it ends up being topical, sometimes it doesn't, you know. But we've got a good arsenal of material right now that we can go out and sort of put in service of.
It's interesting when you write in the book about that there was an intimacy to the business, you know, whether it was broken or corrupt or whatever, but you know, where you had relationships with DJs, where an article in the press could make a difference, where a song, when you think about Woody Guthrie or you think about the power of that music in those circles, how it could convey a message of unity. And I think a lot of what you talk about, you know, in your experience with your fans and what music does is that there is a community. What's scary now, and I think you kind of point your finger at it a little bit, is that it's so fragmented that there's now, you know, you can pick a world to live in that's not the real world.
It's as they say, it's your little bubble, you know.
Yeah.
And, New Jersey's a blue state, and, you know,
sure.
I certainly ran into more Clinton supporters than I did Trump supporters, but I did know both, and I think if there's a benefit to what's occurred, and this was a little similar after the OJ verdict, was that people realized, whoa, there are some other Americans that are my countrymen that I'm not sure I know who they are. So the answer is not to pull back into your little box, but the answer is, well, let's find out. You know?
One way or the other.
You know, and
we're going to find out.
There's plenty of good, solid folks that voted for Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, as well as people who had other agendas. But, you know, to know that, you've got to know some, you know. And
I think a little bit is just this idea of change. You know, that whatever they were afraid of, they voted their fear.
Yeah.
And but the thing that's American that is sort of unnerving a little bit is that sort of like, it'll be all right. It's going to work itself out. And then me, and I'm probably, I don't know about you, but there's part of me that's like, I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you, it's shaking the faith.
Of course. You know? So
we'll see.
Yeah, that's it. That's all we can say right now.
Yeah. And what have you done differently to finish up here? Like, you know, because I know, like, I don't have kids. Like, I've been married a couple of times and didn't have any kids. You can do that if you really focus on it.
It's incredible.
You can put your mind to it. Like, you know, like I can fuck up a relationship. I can be with a woman who wants kids. I'm not going to have kids. Like, but you somehow, you know, I guess through self-work and through, whatever you had to do to get your darkness in place, you know, we're able to rise up. Like, there's that moment after darkness where you said, like, all right, you know, Born to Run's about freedom in that way, selfish freedom. And then there's responsibility. And somehow or another, you've put yourself together enough.
Well, there's license and there's freedom. And those two things are very different.
That's right.
I always say license is to freedom as masturbation is to real sex. It's not bad, but it's not the real
but
thing.
But like you talk a lot about manhood. It seems like you've manned up and you've become a decent, you're always a decent guy, but you're a good father. And how did you do it differently? How conscious are you?
I think you have to believe in the things that you don't know. You know, most people, the things they don't know, they don't believe exists very often, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to sort of believe in the things that you don't know. Know that they're there. Know that they're an important part of a full life. And then you have to go out and you have to find a process in which you come to know those things, whether they're appealing things about yourself or whether they're not. You've got to, and usually you've got to go out and learn about all the ugly things about yourself and all the mistaken things that you've done to construct
a responsible version.
Yeah, you know, you've got to go out and sort of learn those things and incorporate them into your life. In doing so, you learn a lot of forgiveness. You learn, your tolerance increases tremendously, and you learn a lot about the way life happens to you, as I say. And you've got to prepare yourself for good things that come in your life and also the bad things that come when you open yourself up to the world at large. And so that was the biggest change that happened in my 30s that I had to make. It was like going back to learning my first chord on the guitar. I had to learn the first chord on myself and build it just the same way I built the craft of playing and singing, slowly, step by step, angry, sometimes joyful, until finally I was able to put together a me that other people, once they got to know me, would be able to stand, you know? And then once I was able to do that, then, you know, then your kids come along and, you know, you have a wife and a relationship and you do your best to try and not fuck those things up as you go, which is not easy to do. But suddenly you wake up one morning and, you know, there's a life there, you know. So,
and a lot of it's not in your control.
Most of it, some of it is, but a lot of it is not.
And you okay with that?
And you got to be okay with it.
and got to have a little faith.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thanks for talking, Bruce.
My pleasure, man. Thanks a lot.
Okay, well, that's me and Bruce. I hope you enjoyed that. I know. I wish I could have hung out for another couple hours. But read the book. It's very honest. It's all in there. After we were done with our hour, we were walking around a little bit. I told him about Keith Richards and smoking that cigarette with Keith Richards, and he laughed. And I said, hey, man, can I have a pic? I thought maybe he had, like, a lot of musicians have pics with their names on them or whatever. He goes, yeah, man, I can give you a pic. And he's looking through all these pics, and he doesn't have any, like, Bruce Springsteen pics, but he does have a pic that he uses, and it's special because it's this large, thick pic, which I use, a big triangular pic, and on the top there's this thing on it, and it's a piece of sandpaper. He has his guitar tech, or his guy, he puts sandpaper, tape sandpaper, on the top of these picks so Bruce doesn't lose them because his hands get sweaty. And they'll slip out of his hands. So I've got a sandpapered Springsteen pick that I will cherish along with this conversation. So, whew, all right. I gotta play a little guitar now, but, you know, you can split if you want. Happy New Year. Happy New Year. Hey, folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.